revenue. Today's schedule is a public hearing, possible work session, House Bill 2087, 2947, 2948, and 2950. Oh, hi. Mr. Yates is here. Mr. Waters is here. Okay, well, let's do that first. We'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2948. Mr. Yates, do you want to explain 2948 briefly?
In its process of reviewing the tax expenditure report, the House Committee, House Revenue Committee, was looking at the provision of the cigarette tax law, which exempts distributions of cigarettes, samples, packets of 10 or less cigarettes, I think it is, from cigarette tax. And in trying to basically clean up and eliminate the deductions they thought were not necessary or not being used, this is one that they identified essentially to be deleted. So to the extent that any sample packets are distributed after the effective date of this act, they would be subject to a cigarette tax. This, I think, and I don't really know, but I think this is a process or a advertising mechanism that is not used very much anymore.
I haven't seen that. Somebody tried to give me some antacid.
That's not so
down at the mall here. It's very nice. Gave Senator hard time. He lost one of his teeth using it.
Did that for your wrestling business.
All right, well, let's see. In what order of witnesses should we proceed with, Mr. Yates?
Not sure.
Is there anyone here who would like to talk about House Bill 2948? I see. Well, then, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2948. Open up a work session on House Bill 2948. Senator Hartung
moves 2948 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Senator Hartung. Senator Hartung moves House Bill 2948 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Byer?
Aye.
Senator Hartung?
Aye.
Senator Stover?
Aye.
Chair Lyle?
Vote aye. House Bill 2948 is passed to the floor. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2948. Senator Hartung, do you need any of the witnesses to write up the presentation for you? Or?
No, I think I'll handle that one. I mean, Dick did a great job.
Thank you.
It's a demonstration pack.
Yeah. You're going to find a sample pack somewhere.
It used to be in fours. At 10, that's the...
As a non-user...
I don't either, so... Okay. We'll now open up a public hearing on House Bill 2950. Mr. Waters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2950 modifies a few of the Oregon income tax subtractions. There are six that it affects. One is for subtraction for physicians in medically disadvantaged areas. Another is donations of art by the artist. Another is subtraction for local private activity bond interest. Another is subtraction for income earned during service in Vietnam on missing status. Another is subtraction for certain oil tank cleanup costs. And the last one is subtraction for cash payments for energy conservation measures.
And
I provided the committee with a table which lists the each of the areas and some information about each one.
Well, is there anyone here who wants to testify on House Bill 2950? Mr. Harvey? Could we just sign up? Use that invisible ink again.
We did, sir. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Larry Harvey. I'm here today on behalf of the Cultural Advocacy Coalition. As you might expect, we have some concerns regarding the suggestion that the donation for an art object by an artist is still included in this bill. Obviously, we are aware of the fact that this bill originated on the other side of the building. We had some conversations with members over there, and it surprised us that there was less in the bill. So given that we didn't do as good a job as we thought we had over there, we'll accept the responsibility for having let this fall through the cracks. It's our understanding that when the bill came up for a work session, there was no one in the audience. It was very similar to the previous bill that you just considered here. No one was there to speak on behalf of the artists. The point being that the cultural community has worked very hard, under the leadership of Mr. Jim Craven, who's also in the audience today, if you have some historical questions you might want to pose to him. But this is a very important issue. And the bottom line here is that while on one hand it would grant deductibility of the products that you might be using, whether it be canvas or paint or metal or whatever the product might be for the particular object of art, the fact is it totally disregards the talent and the time and the work of the individual, where in this case it would be the artist donating art to a particular museum or some other institution throughout the state. Quite often in instances in more rural communities, and a good example of that might even be Joseph, Oregon, where we have a major foundry and quite a collection of talent there on bronze work and other types of metal sculpture. Those pieces are extremely valuable, and some museums, frankly, would not have the opportunity or wherewithal to be able to purchase that. So within that context, to do this would be a total disincentive for any type of artist to complete this his or her project and then donate it directly. We could give you further examples. You can see with me today is Christine Darcy of the Oregon Art Commission. But the conclusion of my remarks would be that we would strongly recommend that beginning in line 13 of Section 2 of the A and Growth Bill, that the committee consider amending that to remove that language so that, in fact, we could continue to encourage artists and those who are making that contribution to museums around the state to continue to receive some type of a credit for that.
Thank you, Mr. Harvey. Are there questions? Do you want to provide some testimony?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Chris Darcy. I'm the director of the Oregon Arts Commission. We have been before you this session talking about the ways that we could encourage more Oregonians to contribute to our state's arts and cultural institutions. And we've discussed that there are a small number of large givers, and we're trying to encourage the, as Senator Beyer referred to them, the average Joe and Mary to contribute more. We believe that the provision that allows Oregon artists to donate the value of their work of art when it's given to a charitable institution is actually a way that we can encourage them to contribute to the state's arts and culture institutions. this is not a state with a rich philanthropic history, and very often new organizations developing museums find that this aspect of the law allows artists to actually help them build their collections, and we are seated across the street from one of those very new collections, the Hallie Brown Ford Museum at Willamette, which has added to its collection for its new building a considerable number of works of art by living Oregon artists, simply because those artists were able to donate those works of art and receive some credit for it. So I would concur with Mr. Harvey and encourage you to eliminate this section of the proposed bill.
Thank you for that testimony. Are there questions? Let me ask you a little bit about the determining the fair market value. You have it appraised by whom?
Mr. Chair, if I might, I'd like to defer to someone who would have a greater personal knowledge of that, and maybe we can bring her up to the dais to offer that testimony and answer that question. As the committee may have heard me before testify, I have no artistic talent whatsoever. So my value of something would probably be minimal if I worked on it, but I have someone here who could answer that question for you.
Okay. That's fine. And while they're coming up, something I know a little bit about, not too much, is the woman with whom I live on occasion causes me to perhaps make some jewelry kind of purchase. And usually there is an appraisal done, and it often reflects, I think, the retail price, but not necessarily the actual value, because I'm sure we don't get it at any discount. And so I just wonder, in terms of art, if we are giving away, giving someone the income reduction, that the appraisal be quite realistic rather than somebody's view that this is just an extraordinarily outstanding piece of work. That it is probably kind of hard, I think, sometimes to place, you know, I'm sure you can value up the canvas and the paint and the time, perhaps. But as you know, some works will sell for a whole lot more than that, and some.
Yes, I would agree. I've not had that experience with your wife, but I've had it with my own wife.
I'm yeah. Peggy Kindell. I'm a public art manager with the Regional Arts and Culture Council in Portland, Oregon. And we often get calls from people who do want to find out how much is a painting or sculpture worth. There are professional appraisers that people can contact, and they're listed in City's Yellow Pages, as well as referring them to galleries that represent the artists who may be familiar with the artist's work over their life history. And that also helps to determine the value of it.
And is there a requirement that this appraiser have certain...
I would imagine, yeah.
Mr. Chairman, there are accreditation associations for professional appraisers. And I would assume that this language would refer to someone who would be an accredited appraiser.
Okay. It may or may not. Maybe that's something the Department of Revenue would inquire if they had some doubt as to the reduction in income, and then just let someone submit some big number or some number. Maybe they'd want it verified. I don't know.
Mr. Chair, if I might, I would. Our interest is certainly not to distort what any particular piece might be worth or valued as, and we would certainly support the Department of Revenue, if it does not have language via rulemaking, to establish what the criteria would be for ascertaining what a value of a particular piece might be, if that doesn't exist already. It would seem like it would be, in as much as should any particular artist or any citizen, for that matter, be audited for purposes of deductions or contributions, then one would think that that would have to be substantiated somehow, rather other than simply, gee, I saw this price in a market window someplace. So,
okay.
But we're certainly not opposed to appraisal procedures. That's certainly not our point.
Right. But if we do, as you say, and remove that from the bill, we really don't need to get into that.
Not at this time, sir. That's correct.
All right. Well, thank you. Anyone?
Mr. Chair, could I read
sure.
a letter from the acting executive director of the Regional Arts and Culture Council. Always Damrosch. I'm writing today in strong opposition to House Bill 2947, which would eliminate taxable income subtraction for art objects.
947?
2950, I'm sorry.
Okay.
This bill is harmful not only to individual artists, but also to the delicate balance of the art community structure. It is common knowledge that artists have always struggled to make ends meet. In Oregon, private and public support for individual artists is limited, leaving them to find marketing opportunities as they can. At the same time, requests pour in for artists to donate works to the dozens of art auctions held each year. Because these auctions support causes as compelling as cancer and AIDS research, to programs for troubled youth and the homeless, artists want and do participate. There should not be negative financial ramifications for these gifts by artists. If this bill passes, artists will not be able to afford to be generous, and important social programs will suffer. Artists also should be able to benefit from donating works to our state's museums and cultural institutions. Many important collections are built by artists contributing works. Because museums typically have small purchasing budgets, yet strive to reflect the richness of the artistic community. Oregon prides itself as being a leader on so many issues, from the environment to healthcare reform. On this matter, please do not take a huge step backward by curtailing artists from making their works available for charitable efforts, for the enjoyment by our citizens, and for the ongoing growth of our cultural institutions. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Thank you all for your testimony. You are not today? Okay.
Basically, everything you said, I have to grab a letter.
All right, thank you. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2950? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2950. Senator Hartung is
lost it.
Just outside, so we'll open up a work session on House Bill 2950. And Senator Beyer,
sure.
You have.
I would move.
You want to say?
I would move that House Bill 2950 be tabled.
Senator Beyer moves that House Bill 2950 be laid on the table. Now that we have our quorum restored, Senator Hartung, you've heard the motion. Is there discussion of the motion? Is there objection to the motion?
Objection.
Hearing and seeing none, the motion to lay House Bill 2950 is agreed to. Okay. We'll now open up a public hearing on House Bill 2947. Mr. Waters, you are in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2947 is the income tax credit analog of the bill we just worked on. That is, it repeals or sunsets certain income tax credits, as shown in the table that I provided you. Altogether, there are about 7 or 8 credits that are affected by this bill. One is the youth apprenticeship sponsorship credit. Another is credit for contributions of computer equipment. Another is the bone marrow transplant expense credit. Another one is the credit for costs in lieu of nursing home expense. Another one is a income tax credit for those who have suffered loss of limbs. Another is the Oregon Capital Corporation Investment Credit. Another is the fish gleaning credit. Another is the portion of the alternative energy devices residential credit that applies to alternative energy heating devices for pools, spas, and hot tubs. And finally, the fire insurance credit is also affected by this bill.
All right. We have some witnesses signed up on this bill. Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Patterson. I live in Lake Oswego. I'm the owner of Mr. Sun Solar Enterprises, which is a solar energy company in the state. Been in business since 1980. And I'm here to testify against House Bill 2947, specifically Section 21, Lines 20 and 21. That have to do with eliminating the tax credit for solar pool heating. The sheet that I passed to the clerk that will come to you is from the Office of Energy, which isolates the amount of tax credit that was received for solar pool installations in 1998. And as you'll see, there were 47 systems put in the state and a total of $59,000 in tax credits issued for that particular alternative energy device. I would maintain that this amount of money is of minimal significance in consideration of what it would do to our industry. The solar energy community depends very highly on the pool tax credit. It's a significant part of my business, and it is also, in a sense, the champion of all other solar energy systems, in that people that have solar added for their swimming pools are very, very happy with them. It connotes a very positive feeling for solar, and people are then open for other kinds of solar applications because they've had a good experience on pool heating. This is a thing that's done during the summertime when it's sunny and people can see very clearly that the sun is doing them a good service. Secondly, solar pool heating is the environmental champion of all solar applications. If we're talking about renewable energy as a means to make the environment better, solar pool heating generates more BTUs of energy than any other device by far, and it keeps over a ton of CO2 out of the Earth's atmosphere each season. No other alternative energy device can come nearly so close as doing that for as little money as solar pool heating systems cost. They're generally $2,000 to $3,000. And the tax credit is 50% of the cost, up to 50% of the cost, based on the amount of actual energy delivered by the system. There's some misinformation that solar pool heating is something that benefits the rich, and I think that's one of the arguments that enabled this bill to get through the House already. I'm here to testify that that's not the case, that most pool owners are of the middle class. The amount of new installations on solar pool heating systems, it would constitute about a third of my business. And when we're talking about 30 companies like myself at work in the state, to lose a third of our business as a result of this would be very much devastating. I'm licensed in both Oregon and Washington. Washington doesn't have any state income tax credit. They don't have a state income tax. And we did no new pool systems in Washington last year compared to, you know, a dozen or so in Oregon. So the tax credit does make a difference. It serves a good purpose. It gives solar a good name. And I urge you to at least amend this bill to delete those lines of that section.
Other questions? Just ask a couple of things. You said a third of your business, a third of your customers use the solar heating system?
Yes, that'd be right.
And you said if this credit was deleted, that you would lose every one of those customers?
Well, I think if that credit were not available, that that portion of my business would drop considerably. I would probably lose the entire third, I think, because it really comes down to an economic decision, and the tax credit compels the decision.
Would you argue that if someone used solar heating as opposed to some other method, that over time they would save money?
Yes.
Would you then suggest that the folks who are wanting to make this investment don't see the long-range benefit as well as the environmental benefit, or they just don't have the cash on hand now, or?
Well, it simply doubles their payback. It makes it half as attractive. I mean, it makes you, if you had a pool and you wanted to have it warm without spending $600 or $800 a summer for natural gas, and solar can do that for you, and it only costs $3,000, and you get half of that back from the state in tax credit, it's a pretty attractive investment, a three or four-year payback versus a 6 to 8 year payback.
As you know, you were present during the House discussions on this?
No.
Oh, you were not?
No.
Okay.
I don't think anyone from our industry association was present. We just had our quarterly meeting last week, and we were all surprised that it had gone through. And I see that there's several of my colleagues here that, I don't know how that slipped through, but we want to make sure it doesn't continue to slip through.
I think you probably know from being familiar with this legislation generally what the ambition is in reviewing the tax code and credits. And as you know, we describe the events of allowing people to keep their own money as an expenditure of ours and crediting you for what might be a laudable purpose has the effect of reducing the amount of income revenue available to state government to spend on certain programs.
Mm-hmm.
So as we get down to the closing moments here and we're trying to fund schools and everything else, people see, gosh, if we didn't allow this credit, we could more fully fund schools.
Mm-hmm.
So can you help us justify this credit in light of what some view as a critical need to increase funding for K-12?
Sure. I get invited to schools a lot to talk about solar energy, and in fact, I'm spending all day Thursday at Franklin High in Portland. Solar is on the stage at the moment. People are looking at it as something that may be a viable answer to future kind of energy concerns. And of all the different solar applications, so you've left intact the credit for, photovoltaics, for solar hot water, for passive solar home, space heating, all those remain. The only one that's being attacked is solar pool heating. And I maintain that is the flagship of the solar industry. If any were to go, that would be the harshest one for us to accept. And if there has to be any concession as to one of the tax credits disappearing, I would say let it be hot tubs, but not pool systems. It just does too much good for and causes too much positive feeling in the market to have that drop out. And I think that the young people are very, very interested in looking at other alternative energy visions for the future. And I think to keep our greater community feeling positive about solar is something that they would support.
Do you recall when this particular credit was established?
It was, I think about 10 years ago. It wasn't present in the beginning when I first started in business, but it came into existence, I think, in the early to mid-80s.
Okay. Are there other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. Mr. Craven. Before Mr. Craven comes up, if you want to talk about pools, is there anyone else who had signed up that wants to talk specifically about this? All right. This happened in 1978.
It might have been established in 78, but I think it was a period of time when it disappeared, and then it reappeared in the mid to late 80s, I think around 86, 87.
Thank you. Please identify yourself and give us the
best. Well, my name is Andrew, and I live in Portland, Oregon. And there's currently a tax credit available to folks who install solar swimming pool heating systems, solar hot water heating systems, photovoltaic systems. And it's a tax credit program that we understand as kind of it's the state encouraging folks to consider renewable energy as an alternative energy resource in the hope of moving us towards a more environmentally sustainable future. And there's kind of an environmental movement in Oregon that's looking to balance between economic growth. And I think it's important that the solar industry continues to move on, but it needs, at this time, it's kind of delicate, and we need state support for the industry. And without state encouragement and state support, then it would be a serious setback to the industry. Right now, we have one of the best state encouragements in the nation, and other states who are looking to endorse solar energy call us up to find out what we're doing, because we have one of the best programs in the nation. So we are kind of a linchpin in many ways for the whole solar movement around the nation, because they call us up to find out what we're doing right and how we're encouraging solar citizens to go solar. The solar pool heating makes really, like John was saying, makes the most sense, because it's that use of technology where the greatest environmental impact can be had. I was just reading off a Teledyne Lars gas heater on a swimming pool the other day that to heat a pool from 78 degrees to 82 degrees increases the amount of energy people consume by 40% just for those 4 degrees. With a solar system, not only would you get rid of that 40%, but pretty much get rid of the entire need for gas heaters or electric heaters or oil heaters to heat swimming pools. If people have swimming pools, they heat them. They need to heat them because of our, the cool nights and, and we don't really have humid weather here. People don't die to go swimming. But a lot of people have pools. They like to swim. But they do need to heat them, and so they do. If this tax credit is taken away, then I don't see it having that. You're asking John about the fiscal impact and how to justify. And it seems to me like it has such the teeniest little impact. Was it like $60,000? It just doesn't seem. But that amount of money as an incentive by the state will, could possibly break the industry at a time when we're trying desperately to grow. There's a Million Solar Roofs initiative, which is, we're trying to push that through the nation, trying to get a million solar panels on roofs by 2010. And to have the program kind of compromised, I think would be hugely, hugely detrimental. So I encourage you to reconsider this aspect of the bill.
You were not present during the House hearings as well.
I would have loved to have been there. But we just caught wind of it the other day.
Have you had the opportunity to discuss this matter with any of the members of the committee or House members?
Well, I've left messages for everybody.
You haven't?
No. I've got a few responses back where it seems like one or two are more or less inclined to vote favorably or negatively about the bill. Apparently some people are not strongly inclined towards tax credits, which I can understand, but it seems like there's a lot. It would just cripple our industry by, you know.
I can do the whole pool installation and.
Yes, I do. System. Yeah, I do solar pool heating, hot water heating, and photovoltaic system.
And the what?
Photovoltaic, which is solar electric systems.
Okay.
Converting light energy into electric energy.
Sure. Well, are all of yours, all of the heating systems you provide, benefited by a credit or not?
Oh yeah, I am also licensed, bonded, and insured in Washington State. For reasons I don't know. Just on the hope, and I try. I do home shows, and I'm, you know, but I haven't made a sale in Washington State in years. And then I've been doing this since 86 or 87, and I think I've only done like 2 installations in Washington during that period of time. And it's not for lack of effort.
Is my assumption correct that the individual who went to this kind of heating system would save money over time, even if no credit was allowed?
Yeah. But, you know, really, the mentality of Americans is if it doesn't pay for itself in 2 years, it's completely, you know, crazy. If it doesn't pay for itself in 2 years, it's not a viable option. They'd rather go ahead and pay expensive monthly bills. You know, it's got to make 25% return or 30% return on investment, or else it's, you know, just trading money.
Are there other questions? Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate it.
My name is Frank Mignola, and this year I'm president of the Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association. It's a small industry in the state. We've got about 15% of our members here today because this is important to the industry. Solar industry, Congress, and the United States Department of Energy have embarked on a major program to establish a self-reliant solar industry by 2010 as part of the National Million Solar Roofs Program. 20 years ago, there was a very small conservation industry, and today it is contributing substantially to our economy. The goal of the Million Solar Roofs Program is to establish the solar industry that will equally contribute to our economy. During this initial period, where we're just getting started, it is essential to nurture the industry. It's been really struggling and just barely keeping alive these years. And tax credits for solar pool heating are extremely important to the solar industry in this state. In the Portland area, a significant majority of new systems installed are solar pool heating systems. Without the tax credit, the industry in the Portland area will be severely damaged. And this is a time when we're just beginning to start to move on solar. And removing the tax cut now will really hurt our base as we start to get off the ground. As Andrew said, about $60,000 a year is being spent on pool heating tax credits. This is enabling us to put off purchases of electricity elsewhere. And for the state, it's a bargain. But I think it's the main thing that it's one of the cornerstones that is keeping the industry going over this time period. Oregon right now sells is number 5 in the sale of solar heating systems across the United States. And so I think that this one issue here is something that will really hurt the industry as we're starting to make a major effort and push to get the industry on a self-sustaining basis.
Other questions? I'm so struck by the fact that with a credit that only a third of people who are installing pools are using this heating technique. Is the initial expense much greater?
No, that's a third of the business. That's a third of our business activity is in solar pool heating.
Okay, but in pools generally, how many people are heating a pool
Well, there's a
where or by the
ton of reasons not to buy, it seems.
Not to buy.
Just to buy, yeah, well, yeah, solar. There is a perception, you know, that solar doesn't work in the Northwest, which it does. And it doesn't work any, it works best for heating swimming pools, but it's only a seasonal use where we get the most sun.
Is that a perception or reality?
Oh, that's a reality, absolutely.
Is it initially more expensive?
You know, I don't really know why. Yeah.
One of the big impacts is the financial impact of coming up with the money initially. It's hard to get. We aren't established like the car industry where we can get an easy bank loan. Someone just signs on the line. We're too small an industry for that. And we're working on that. And that's one of the problems there, is the financing of these systems. They're right in the range where people really take a look at this as the pocket book. And by having this tax incentive here, it just tips the scale and makes it doable. And as we get stronger as an industry and we can start financing these on a 5-year basis, or something like that, then it'll make more sense to do it without the tax credit. And this is what we're working towards. But until we get to that state, we need this help.
It's also, solar heating swimming pools is not necessarily something that, I mean, it's a very specialized industry, and people in the swimming pool industry aren't necessarily pushing it. They're pushing their own heaters and chemicals and pumps and filters. And so they aren't really part of the solar movement by and large. And so the solar option frequently is not actually being introduced to folks. And so and so people don't really even know it's available without our aggressive tactics to try to introduce the idea of solar energy to folks.
There is also some competition with natural gas, and that makes it hard. Natural gas is fairly inexpensive, and that if you start to compare it against electricity, the payback time is fairly quick. If you compare it against natural gas, the payback time is much longer.
And also there's the appearance. People have a hard time with the way solar looks. And so, but, you know, if they're able to see that the state stands behind the program and then the benefits and the merits of solar by itself, those in conjunction help them to make a decision to go solar. But without the tax credit.
Andrew, you had responded a little bit to my question about the pool funding issue, and I would certainly agree that based on the amount of credit used in a 2-year cycle, you're probably not likely going to cause any substantial reduction in class size if we eliminated this credit. But help a little bit with the notion that the public might say, you know, you all are protecting a credit for people who want a swimming pool. And is that really one of life's necessities? You're talking about how you might heat that pool. But in effect, the notion that might get out of this building is that, you know, they're making it easier for people to get the pool of their choice heated by the system they desire. And we've really made life better for pool users as opposed to maybe some other organisms who aren't quite as advantaged.
I see it as more of an environmental issue, that people who have swimming pools are going to heat them, and that's affecting all of our environment. And
are there other questions? Thank you both for testifying.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who cared to testify about this particular tax credit? All right, then we'll ask Mr. Craven to come forward.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jim Craven, representing the Oregon Council of the American Electronics Association. Our association includes both electronic manufacturers and software companies throughout the state. We have about 150 members, employing about 70,000 Oregonians. And House Bill 2947, Section 2, repeals what we think is a valuable public policy the tax credit for donations of computers to educational institutions. This provision became law originally in 1985, and originally for quite some time was directed only at donations to institutions of higher education. Just last session in 1997, Senator Farioli introduced a bill, carried it successfully to completion, that expanded this tax credit to also apply to donations of computer equipment to K-12 schools, and at the same time also extended the sunset date to the year 2004. Those are the two provisions of Senate Bill 1147 last session. That bill passed on narrow margins of 54-0 in the House and 26-2 in the Senate. And we think this credit has been a valuable incentive to companies to make such donations. Certainly not every company that makes a donation of technology equipment avails themselves of this credit. But nevertheless, in our conversations with the educational institutions, they have often said that this is more a credit that's valuable to them when they make the charitable request. And it gives them a modest piece of leverage to try to encourage someone to make the donation. I do want to point out, because it often comes up, this is only for new equipment. This is not a tax credit for a company who wishes to dispose of outdated or outmoded equipment. This is new equipment only. It's a 10% of the fair market value. And I think to the general question that the chair has posed today about the revenue loss versus, say, trying to aggregate the most money for K through 12, I mean, this is a perfect example of return on investment, basically a 10-to-1 return on investment. For a 10% tax credit, a school or a university gets 100% of the value of the equipment. So if we're interested in trying to help our schools, this is a perfect example of a way to do so. So it is a modest, a few $100,000 tax expenditure on the general fund, but it leverages millions of dollars of equipment to our universities and K-12 institutions. So our recommendation to the committee would be on 2947 to delete Section 2 and maintain this credit as established last session.
Mr. Craven, were you also absent during the discussions held by the House Revenue Committee?
Mr. Chair, no, I wasn't. I was given the opportunity to testify for about 2.5 minutes on this provision, a similar kind of testimony that I just provided you. I'm not sure. I can't speak for the basis of the House Committee's decision, though I would point out that the House Revenue Committee has 9 members, 5 of whom were not here last session to vote on this bill, as all the members of this committee did.
Yeah, I understand that.
And we did not, Mr. Chair,
because your testimony was extraordinary.
It may have been a minute shorter in the House.
I think I'm serious. You made some very good points, and I think justified the support that many of us gave this for this past session. Do you have any sense as to why this credit was picked out for elimination?
Mr. Chair, I don't want to speak for others' motives. I recall the discussion in the House Committee had a long list of credits that were before them over a number of days of hearings. When they went into the final work session, they had the list before them, and they kind of just went item by item rather rapidly. My guess, I don't want to, two issues. One, a couple of members of the committee said, well, it doesn't look like the credit's being used enough, because I think the revenue impact is $250,000 for the biennium. On other credits, of course, some of the comments were, it's being used too much, it costs the state too much money. I do recall a few comments that it didn't look like this was being used enough, and therefore it wasn't necessary. I think the expansion through K-12 is a rather recent phenomenon. Sometimes on these, the word needs to get out. People need to communicate to their tax managers, and avail themselves of the credit. That's about as best I can do. And my only other comment, and staff was there present, when they went into the penultimate day to go through the grand list and make all their decisions, this happened to be, I think, one or two on the list. And my sort of gut feeling was that they started off with an ambitious day. They whacked this credit, and as they went down the day, didn't do a whole lot more, but I happened to be early in the draw. So.
All right. Are there questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Monroe. Next.
Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jack Monroe, speaking today, I guess, on behalf of the American Insurance Association. I'm here with a set of amendments denoted 947-A3, which would delete Section 24 of the printed bill, which deals with fire insurance premiums. I guess anticipating some of the questions that I've heard asked, I did appear at the cattle call on the other side on this measure, but was not in the room for the birth of 2947, and so probably cannot tell you precisely why this was included, although there was, I guess, one hit that came out earlier in the first session that I'll be happy to share with you. Basically, this is a credit. Let me go back and say in the 60s, in order to provide a dedicated source of funding to the fire marshal's operation, the legislature enacted a 1% tax on fire insurance policies and those fire-related portions of multi-peril policies, a multi-peril policy being your homeowner's policy, which covers property and a number of things that would include fire, and the prorated share of whatever that premium amount is that ends up being dedicated to funding the fire marshal's activities. At the same time that dedicated funding was set up, an offset was created against insurance premium and or corporate excise taxes that flow into the general fund now and historically have been, I don't know, the third or fourth greatest source of funding to that general fund. The only hint that I can give you, I guess, about why this occurred was discussion in that first hearing that I testified on, at least on the part of one party, the vice chair, who wasn't concerned about the offset here, but had some concerns about putting the fire marshal's operation back into the general fund and therefore eliminating the dedicated source of funding that came from this source. If that was the intent, I don't think they executed it well here because all they did was to essentially repeal the tax credit or the offset, which in effect would be, when this repealed, a tax increase that we would be faced with. So the amendment that I noted before is simply deleting that language. Certainly, if this Oregon legislature or any future Oregon legislature wants to take up the issue of how the fire marshal's operation is funded, clearly they ought to do so. But as I say, the way in which it's been done here is nothing more than a delayed tax increase that would be imposed on companies that they in turn would pass on to their policyholders. So, with that, I'm obviously recommending the adoption of that amendment if you choose to move the bill.
Are there questions?
Thank you.
Wendy Johnson? Are you with the pool crowd? All right. Thanks for being here. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2947? All right, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2947. Open up a work session on House Bill 2947 just for the purposes of getting some thoughts here from members. Senator Beyer?
Mr. Chair, I'm overwhelmed by the testimony.
Yes.
And by the obvious major amount of money that we'd be saving by this. In fact, I'm so overwhelmed that I would move
Wait. I don't want you resting this one quite yet.
All right, I will wait.
Of course you can make the motion.
I will wait until others are present.
or I can express an opinion.
No, to do that.
I'd be happy to have the opinion of the others on this committee, but it would be the chair's the desire to replace the provisions of House Bill 2947 with a proposal to repeal the political tax credit, which would generate or would save, make available for needs of this state, according to the tax expenditure report, about $8 million, which is substantially more than House Bill 2947 would accomplish. Now, we don't have that amendment before us, but I would ask that that be drafted. And then this bill is not put on the table. I'd like to have that considered by this committee. I'm not extraordinarily hopeful it would pass. It might pass this committee, but I know there'd be substantial opposition.
How much time do you want to spend on the floor?
Less than we did for legalizing professional wrestling.
I don't think that would be likely.
Anyway, that's the chair's desire on this particular bill, but those who came before us today, unless I hear something different from the committee, I don't think there's a desire to remove the particular credits that are included in this bill. I think your motion obviously states that, and if Senators Hartung or Starr want to make a comment with those regarding any of the credits under review in 2947, you're certainly welcome to do so, or you can...
I do not choose to repeal any of those credits.
All right. There are, let me just say this, and maybe if we bring back an amendment, maybe we should have a couple of sets. There are some credits here, and Mr. Waters, you can shore us up on this, but there are some here that have zero impact and perhaps are in the nature of cleaning up the statute. That fish gleaning apparently has no impact. And no one was here to defend a fish gleaning credit.
I think, Mr. Chair, that one has been inactive, although there are some legislation to reactivate it, this session that I have seen. The first item, the youth apprenticeship sponsorship credit, that language is also moribund, at least. The program was converted from a credit into a wage reimbursement, so the credit portion of it is they no longer applicable.
Okay. And well, how about loss of limbs? No one came here and ended that credit?
Possibly not. You had
zero impact.
Well, that's the reason for the zero impact is because the sunset wouldn't be until the end of the next biennium.
Oh, okay. Is it, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Beyer.
Was there much use on this at all, Ted?
Senator Beyer, not a lot, actually. I remember this. Yeah, the tax expenditure report estimates the utilization in the 99-01 biennium would be less than $50,000 total for that credit.
That's in the ballpark with the other one. Comment on a couple of others. Bone marrow, I don't think that probably had a lot of use, although I remember discussion. I think that was either last session or 95, and the gentleman that made a case on it at that time did not expect it to be a huge credit, but he thought it was a big, sort of in the order of what Mr. Craven was saying in terms of computers. It was a good thing to get people's attention so that they would do that. I don't know whether that's worked or not, but he made a very convincing case to the Revenue Committee in the House and apparently in the Senate also to enact it last time. A big return, potential big return on very low costs.
We're pursuing this with not a whole lot of input from those who might be affected. I'm wondering, maybe Mr. Waters, would you recall if anybody spoke to those credits during the House review? The bone marrow?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe anyone spoke to that particular credit. In fact, most of the ones that are in here are in here because they weren't spoken to.
All right. Well, perhaps we could, for the next time we get together, have amendments drafted, listed to the committee here that would reflect the repeal of the youth apprenticeship sponsorship.
I'm just wondering, Mr. Chair, unless you put the other one in there, I would not support political tax credit. I can't imagine that it's worth the time to even put it on the floor.
Well, there may be some value in cleansing the statute of credits that just are not in use and get turned up in the tax expenditure report just to reflect inactivity and another zero impact. I don't know why we go through that exercise.
Mm-hmm. I'm just looking at that long list of bills that we have to pass to get up in here in the next few weeks.
Well, why don't we do this? Those that have a zero impact, Mr. Waters, would you cause an amendment to be drafted that would eliminate those categories, the youth apprenticeship, sponsorship, loss of limbs under 316.079, Oregon Capital Corporation Investment, 315.504, Fish Gleaning. Got a fire insurance credit as well. And draft those in one amendment. And then you would bring the ones that had a zero general fund impact. You all have the list.
We have the list, but I'm wondering the loss of limb. That was because it wouldn't sunset until a certain number of times. It's not that they may not be in the same category as some of the others. It's just that the impact isn't immediate.
Right, Mr. Chair, this sheet would probably give you a better idea of the activity.
Does that have an impact?
Yes. Some of these that you mentioned would. Loss of limbs, for example.
All right, yeah, the capital corporation investment is zero.
Right.
Fish cleaning is zero.
Right.
Youth apprenticeship sponsorship is zero.
Right.
Draft an amendment that reflects the repeal of those three, if you would, please, into one amendment. And then if you would, draft an additional amendment that would repeal the political tax credit, and we'll take that issue up separately. I won't make the members of this committee knowing their desire. three of us on that committee.
Sure.
So if you do that, then we'll bring that back to our next opportunity. Anything further to come before us on 2947? If not, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2947. So now, I'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2087. Everybody looking for this. And we have John Van Landingham and Mary Hanlon. Lynn Schlosser, do you all want to come up? Do you want to do that now, Lynn? And Mr. Waters, you could lead off if you want.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2087 increases the cap on the total amount of tax credit allowed for lending institution loans for the construction, development, or rehabilitation of housing for low-income families. This cap is increased from its current level of $4 million to $5 million under the bill. And the bill also extends eligibility to loans made by until December 31st, 2009. And it would apply to loan certifications occurring on or after January 1st, 2000.
All right. We thank you, and we welcome all of you. If any order you choose, just give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is John Van Landingham. I'm a lawyer with Lane County Law and Advocacy in Eugene, Springfield. I'm speaking as secretary of the Oregon Housing Lobby Coalition, acting on behalf of Frank Bronner, who is at this moment driving with his wife to Alaska for the fishing trip of his life, he says. The Housing Lobby Coalition has been a long-time supporter of this tax credit, which was created in 1989 with the support of the banking industry and the affordable housing advocates. It was first functional in 1991. It took two years to make it work with the Department of Revenue. I'm also a board member of NOAA, which is a consortium of private banks, and Murray Hannon will speak to that. I've given you two handouts, a one-page list of the members of the Housing Lobby Coalition, which shows you the unusual combination of everybody interested in housing who supports affordable housing. I've also given you a group of six photos of affordable housing projects around the state, Roseburg, Ontario, Portland, that are demonstrations of affordable housing projects which have been funded using the affordable housing tax credit. It does two things. It lowers the interest rate and therefore the rents on projects. And secondly, it leverages private money. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Hamlin. I'm the executive director for Network for Oregon for Affordable Housing, which is a bank consortium. 19 Oregon banks participate in NOAA to make low-income affordable housing loans. We do the permanent financing for these loans, and we've made approximately $50,000 worth of these loans. We have a $55 million line of credit from these banks. Our loans are, as I said, permanent loans, and they require sound underwriting for any multifamily housing project would. Without the tax credits, it would have a dramatic impact on these loans. The tax credit program is oversubscribed. 75% of the loans that we make use the tax credits. They have an impact on the families living, as John suggested, on the families living in these units with approximately $60 to $80 a month reduction in their rents. And their rents, by the time you get to someone's net income for this affordable housing, is approximately half of their monthly income, which at 50% of median income is about $1,000 a month. So it has a tremendous impact on working Oregonians. These projects are filled mainly with working poor, what we would consider working poor families. But we'd strongly encourage support to increase this.
Can I correct one thing?
Sure.
NOAA has made $50 million worth of loans in projects, not
$50,000.
Oh, sorry. That'd be true. It's just not complete.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the record. My name is Lynn Schessler, Deputy Director of the Housing and Community Services Department. The city staff has identified the two key points of this bill, one that extends the current sentence at an additional 10 years and increases the credit cap amount from the current $4 million to $5 million. What that translates to, because the tax credit is a 4% interest rate reduction, it allows the current limitation on loans that can have the credit, it moves it from the current limitation of $100 million to $125 million. By the end of this biennium, we'll have 6,000 units that are covered by the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, and that's comprised of 150 different projects around the state. The addition of the $1 million in tax credits will allow us to cover an additional 1,250 approximately additional units that can, again, be distributed around the state. This is a program that's highly regarded. It's highly utilized. Each time we have a competition for these tax credits, and we do that twice a year, and we meter out the tax credits through the course of the biennium, we have two, three, sometimes five times as many requests as we have tax credits available. So you can see that it's well utilized. Some technical points that I'll make related to this. The projects must pencil before the tax credit is applied. That's an important principle here. We don't use this tax credit to make a project work. The project has to work at least at market rates before the tax credit is applied. The interest rate reduction, as Mary indicated, reduces the rents then $80. That makes a significant change, and then the rents that need to be charged makes it affordable to a lot more families. And the long-term use of this tax credit over its 20-year period is insured by the restrictive covenants that were required to be placed on the property. So it isn't like they can tell us a story up front. The restrictive covenants we have dictate how much the rents will be reduced by unit per month throughout the life of the tax credit. And with that, I'll open up to any questions you might have.
Are there questions? Could you tell me the credit goes from 4 to 5 million? Am I reading that correctly?
The cap on the credit,
yes. The cap on the credit.
Increases from 4 million to 5 million. That additional $1 million of credit then translates to $25 million of loans.
I wouldn't we want to increase that amount?
Mr. Chair, I'd be delighted if you increased that amount. But we thought that was a reasonable request that we proposed.
Is this the only request you made?
Mr. Chair, if I might, the Housing Lobby Coalition initially supported a $2 million increase from 4 to 6. When we developed our agenda last fall, and the department felt that that the climate was such that $1 million would be what we would succeed with. So the honest answer to your question is that we can spend, not just spend, but we can use effectively around the state more than the $1 million increase. And it is second to the housing trust fund. It's probably the second most important component in producing affordable housing units.
Did anybody ask you a similar question when this bill was on the other side?
No, sir.
Did you ever suggest that you go beyond this?
Mr. Chair, our thinking with Chairman Strobeck was that we were appreciative to get the $1 million. I'm paraphrasing what Mr. Bonner said to me. He and I met with the chairman, and Mr. Bonner thought that we would be thankful to get to one day.
Senator Barr?
Following up on that, how much you mentioned you had a competition last year. How much were you short in terms of the credits and meeting the needs?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, as I indicated, depending on the individual competitive round, this most recent round, because we let the public know very clearly we did not have an abundance of credits, the ratio of oversubscription was 2 to 1. We had 2 requests for every tax credit that we actually had. In prior sessions, that ratio has varied between 2, 3, 4. Sometimes we have 5 times as many requests as we have credits available.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, the state contacted us and asked us if we would be capable of making an additional twice as many loans if there were twice as many requests, and we indicated that we would be able to, and the main strength is limited tax credit.
Anything
else?
No, they're Senator Starr is not going far. Senator Hartung, I mean, what's their truth, I think.
Well, I don't want to get in the way of progress, but I wouldn't be adverse to thinking about an increase. You're back here. You were here 2 years ago. I wouldn't be among the shocked if you were back another year, because the need probably won't vanish. I'm not unmindful of what we estimate to be the revenue impact, but it's as witnessed the number of supporters, and it's the kind of thing that I think is worthy of our participation.
What do you think of?
Seven? Well, I would. Six doesn't bother me. And again, I don't know how this would be received in another part of the building, and I do not want to cause this to go to some conference committee that never meets and have the program be in jeopardy.
That is a significant increase from that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, obviously that would create the opportunity for us to cover $50 million worth of additional loans, that would translate to something like 2,500 additional units. And that's new construction units. If, as we've seen around the state, we begin to transition to acquisition and rehab, the expense of those projects is not as great, so that may even stretch farther.
Well, we can... Let me do something here. Is there anyone else who wanted to testify on House Bill 2087? If not, we'll close the public hearing. You can stay there. On House Bill 2087. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2087. And I would just ask the committee to entertain the thought of increasing the cap. Yeah, if we, and I would, well, may ask the witnesses to participate as well, but our strategy here could be, or our move could be, that we would do this today, if we have majority to do so, and send the message over to the House, or see if we pass it on our Senate floor, and then we have a discussion, or we just have this discussion, and we go visit with the House counterparts who will make some judgment about this and see whether or not they would agree, and then we would hold off final action on this bill until we've had a chance to have that discussion. Yes, Senator Byer.
My thought would be, I don't think you could do more than two. It would
right.
Happen either one or two. I suspect if either of those numbers in the waning days of the session are going to find not kind of make or break the budget deal. Probably be safer with one.
With the current figure?
No.
Oh, with one?
Yeah.
Yes. I would. Yeah, I think that would be.
Make sense of that?
Very.
If you would set them up.
So again, I've got the principal promoters here, and I do not want to.
All right, Mr. Chair, I spoke to Mr. Martinez, our political consultant, and he suggested that action today would be the best course.
He said what?
He suggested that action today and the $2 million from 4 to 6.
To 2. To go to 6.
Go to 6. And the chair moves?
The chair would move. Well, we'll need to then draft an amendment.
Oh, no, it's just a single number. We can just do it.
All right, the chair is overruled by the committee members again.
Good.
And we would move that the $5 million be $6 million.
It would be on page 2, line 23.
Page 2, line 23. Good. Thank you. That's it.
That's 1 becomes...
All right. 5 becomes 6. 5 becomes 6 on page 2, line 23. Is there a discussion of the amendment? Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, it is so ordered. It is agreed to. And Senator Byer would move House Bill 2087 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Vote aye. House Bill 2087 is passed to the floor. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2087. Thank you all.
Good job.
And the carrier would be... okay. I'll carry it. Is there anything further to come before the committee? If not, we are adjourned.